morning and welcome to week two of Israel's Chief Rabbis, Clergy, or Politicians, an inspired name if there ever was one. I apologize for this not being week one. I had to be out of town at the last minute last week, but Rabbi Ziering filled in, and I understand it went very well. I'm grateful for him for switching around. What it means is that I'm going to do weeks two and three, and then he'll do week four as he was going to originally. So this week, we'll be talking about Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman. Before we get started on it, if anyone is not registered, we have a sign-in sheet over here, which will enable you to receive the emails about the class, the updates, as well as a link to the audio recordings. If you have to miss a week, then you'll be able to download the audio recording. So if you're not already receiving emails for the class, please make sure that before you leave, you sign in. If you're already receiving the emails, that means you're registered and we're good. The class materials are also over there. If anyone needs a source sheet, does everyone have? Okay, as long as everybody has, great. Okay, so the following was going to be the overall introduction to the series back when I was doing week one, and I think it's still valuable. I don't know how much time Rabbi Ziering spent on it last week. The question of what exactly the role of a chief rabbi is. What should be the task, what should be the job description of the chief rabbi of the state of Israel? Religious leader. What does that mean in practice?
Advisor to the government.
On halachic issues, on issues of Jewish law. Yeah, that's what you're going to say, Paul, also. Okay. What else? Is that it?
Yeah. He's forsake on halacha, issues of serious issues.
Right, to decide issues of halacha, of Jewish law. Okay, yes?
He might be born in Jewish law, but Jewish. One of these words has to morality, ethics, something in there. That it should be more than just law, but intent as well.
Right, more than law, but you can go very broad and say Judaism, Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought, Jewish ideals. Yeah? To establish a Jewish path for the country. Okay. Very tricky in a democracy. Yes, Paul.
Be involved with hiring and firing rabbis under certain circumstances.
Oh boy. To oversee the country's rabbinate. Well, you know that is a double-edged sword, right? On the one hand, it creates oversight. On the other hand, it creates monopoly. There are seats still over here for anyone coming in. Don't be afraid. So all of these, I think, have legitimacy. I want to show you something in the first source on your sheets. This is a piece of a ruling of an Israeli court of appeal in a case involving, unfortunately, a chief rabbi who ended up in jail. And he was appealing to try to get out after a couple of years. And they talked about the importance of the role of the chief rabbi. And this is from their ruling. They said, they, meaning the chief rabbis, appear before students and schools. The rabbis also visit wounded IDF soldiers, those wounded in acts of enmity, meaning terrorism. And they conduct visits of comfort for the bereaved families. So this is not the national enforcement of Jewish law that we're talking about. Now, this is personal, right? Visiting the wounded, visiting bereaved families, making visits to schools. They're representing Judaism for everyone on a macro level and on a micro level. The chief rabbis act as well in the international arena and in representing the country in interfaith forums and various events across the world. This, in addition to their role as heads of the rabbinical court system in Israel and as judges in the chief rabbinical court. It is also noted on the website of the chief rabbinate that the chief rabbinate serves the diaspora, not only as a spiritual authority for halachic questions, but also as a central resource for information for all Jewish communities and all kosher supervising agencies around the globe. From this it emerges that the chief rabbi has a broad sphere of influence in Israel and the diaspora, in the spiritual and ethical realm, as well as the administrative realm, in a broad range of weighty areas. This is an extremely broad job description. The level of responsibility involved is scary. It's not only Jewish law, although that in and of itself is certainly a full-time job. It is also being essentially the national Jew, so to speak. You're the one who people are supposed to contact in the event there, not supposed to contact, are supposed to hear from in the event that there is a crisis, there is a moment requiring that Judaism weigh in. So, with that kind of national and international and personal vision for the position, it seems clear that your chief rabbi is not simply a rabbi. He's not simply an agent of Torah. The chief rabbi had better be a politician as well. Right? Politician in the finest sense of the word, not in the bad sense of the word, but politician in the sense that this is a person who has to know the people, has to interact with the people. Essentially, the chief rabbi holds a position that you could think of as an uber pulpit position. Something that is a super pulpit, responsible to the nation and beyond. So what I'm hoping to do, both today in talking about Rabbi Unterman, and next week as well, is to talk about how the chief rabbi manages these roles as a representative of Torah and as a leader of communities. What kind of traits does a chief rabbi need in order to fill these roles? Diplomacy is a good one. Yeah? What else? Needs to be able to listen. Right? Sorry?
Tolerance. Flexibility.
Flexibility. Yeah.
Wisdom.
Definitely wisdom. I'm thinking wisdom of Solomon grade. Right? Like that level of wisdom. Knowledge, certainly. Right? You know, one of the fundamental points about Jewish law, which is often missed, is that you can't really offer guidance in halacha. You can't really offer guidance in Jewish law unless you know, that's going to be appropriate for circumstances. It's going to be flexible for situations unless you know it well. The less you know, the less flexibility you have. You know, if you're ruling out of a book, or just based on, well, I heard so-and-so say, you're not able to adjust for situations and to accommodate for needs. So a high level of Torah knowledge is for sure going to be a piece of this. What about in terms of... Yeah, Judith.
I think Chief Rabbi needs to understand a historical perspective and a political knowledge, because the impact of the decisions will not just be for that time, but it could be other times, and impact into his capacity with international...
Absolutely. Right? Historical knowledge, political perspective are going to be very important. And I think you also touch on here the element of values. The values that the chief rabbi holds are going to be very important here. So somebody who has a drive for unity, right, is going to approach things one way. Where somebody who says, you know what, let each do his own, and they'll do this, and they'll do that, and it doesn't matter if different communities develop with different ideals, is going to take a very different perspective on the issues of the day. And I'm not sure that you could really go too far in either direction without being destructive. Meaning, somebody, when you say the word unity, it's sort of, you know, apple pie and Chevrolet, right? Like, what could be bad about unity? But what could be bad is if it's a drive for uniformity, in which you obliterate all differences between groups in the aim of saying, well, now we'll all be unified. On the other hand, if you overbalance towards each group does its own thing, you create a situation in which groups don't identify with each other. They don't see each other as one nation anymore, and rifts develop. So you need some sort of a balance in that regard. Morris.
Innovation in halacha, in the sphere of halacha, because the state of Israel is unique. Today's modern state is really unique in history, because you're making halacha for a nation rather than for individual communities. Mm-hmm. And you're going to encounter situations which probably have not really been dealt with and the typical halachic shiva shivan.
Right. Right. I mean, certainly the perspective of Jewish law is going to have to be broader. You're going to have to look at things not only in terms of the case at hand in a very narrow way, which is the way that classically you could, but its impact on relationships between Jews, its impact on having a state. I assume Rabbi Ziering talked about this a little bit last week when he talked about Rabbi Yoren and the IDF. Because there is a major example of this. So you're absolutely right, that's going to have to be part of it. And the perspective on the diaspora community. I think as people come in, like to this side, I think I'm going to sort of shift a little bit. You know, try it this way and see how this goes. But there's no good way, unfortunately, with the table set up this way, there's no good way to stand. So we do the best we can. Yes?
We started, you know, talking about, you're asking about traits of the chief rabbi, but maybe you could give us a little advice on how they choose the chief rabbi.
Right. Right, so I'll do it now instead of later. Basically the way a chief rabbi is currently elected is you have a body of people who are selected from different groups, different sort of interest groups within the community. You have obviously a large rabbinic representation there, and they select the chief rabbi. The chief rabbi serves a 10-year term. That was a change. That originally it was a life selection. And then, for various reasons, it ended up changing to be a 10-year term about 30, 40 years ago. And that's the way it works today. There is an Ashkenazi chief rabbi. There's a Sephardi chief rabbi. There is a movement in Israel to just say, forget that, let's just have one chief rabbi. Who needs to have separate? Historically, there were reasons for having a separate Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbi. Under the Turks, under the Ottomans, you had separate communities. And they had their own identities. And that's the way it carried forward. But there is a movement to just say, let's have one and not have Ashkenazi versus Sephardi. Moshe and then Gary.
I think he needs to represent the unity and segments of the society, which today do not see him as representing them. By that I mean reform, austerity, and also
right. So what I'm going to say is this. I'm trying deliberately to make this a general definition of what a chief rabbi must be, as opposed to speak to any particular situation, because I think it's valuable to look at it not in terms of the lens of a particular chief rabbi and that chief rabbi's experience, but to look at it in terms of what is the model that we're talking about in order to understand the clergy and politician sides of it. But I think your central point, that the chief rabbi should be somebody who represents everybody, is one worthy of discussion. Because it's not simple and straightforward. It's sort of like the unity thing, right? When I say unity, everyone says, oh, of course, unity is wonderful. But you do have to, and the same thing is true for this. Of course they should represent everybody. It should be for men and women. It should be for Jews wherever they identify, or even if they don't identify at all along the spectrum. They should be able to find something within it. However, you have to ask yourself, at what point do you cease to be anything when you're trying to be the chief rabbi for a group that's so large that you will include people for whom Judaism simply means I have Jewish parents, or not even that. I simply feel close to Judaism. And then on the other hand, people who live their lives by every word that they understand Jewish law to be. You have to ask yourself, in order to do that, in order to be for everybody, do you have to homogenize your message to such a point that there's no message left at all? Okay, that's fair. Communication, no, I think communication is fair. I think that's a fair expectation. I just think that you have to ask yourself at a certain point, if I'm going to make him the chief rabbi for everybody, he's going to be the chief rabbi for nobody. That's the, that's something that's very important to think about, I think, as we talk about these issues. And we're going to get into specifics when we talk about Rabbi Unterman, and you'll see what I mean. Gary.
Empty. Most shops, okay? They're empty. So therefore,
communicate to their children are probably different values than what a lot of them say. So therefore, you should be approaching the schools, and you should also be approaching the community and telling these schools with the children, these are the laws of Judaism.
Right. So I would suggest the following. I think your central point about speaking to the youth and about being concerned for how Judaism is carried to the youth, I think that's for sure has to be a value of the chief rabbi. How the chief rabbi does it, I think, is going to vary. And I think it's important to recognize, if you're going to put all of this on the chief rabbi and not on an infrastructure that is at the disposal of the chief rabbinate, it is never going to happen. I mean, it's absurd to think that one person is going to be able to do this. But having the chief rabbi prioritize this element of the future and the youth, I think, yes, I think that's critical to the mission. Okay. We've now given sort of a general overview of what, you know, the ideals are and what we're looking for. And by the way, for anyone who came in, there are still materials over there. I believe there are still materials over there. Yes. So please do take. Okay. So let's talk about Rabbi Unterman. Now, Rabbi Unterman is at a disadvantage in this regard, because you discussed Rabbi Gorin last week. And Rabbi Gorin has such a flashy biography, which he describes himself in his autobiography, that no one can compete with that. Nothing is going to be as exciting as Rabbi Shlomo Gorin. So I apologize. That's just the way it is. I should note, though, someone had registered for the class with the last name of Unterman. I don't know if that person is here, but I wanted to know if they're a relative. Yes? You are a relative. Okay, so you will add to the biography. You are now on the spot to add to the biography. And hopefully I get what I'm going to say right. Okay, so Rabbi Unterman was born in Brisk in the year 1886, I believe. He was what's called an Eloi. Anyone know what an Eloi means? Right. From the word al, to be above. This was somebody who was recognized as a kid to be a prodigy, to be above and beyond. No doubt passed down within the family. Absolutely. So he studied in various yeshivot, various academies, including the Volozhin Yeshiva and the Mir. Now, the Volozhin Yeshiva just was the greatest yeshiva of Europe over the period from the end of the 18th century until the end of the 19th century. That 100-year period, 100-year plus, it was shut down at the end of the 19th century and then reopened for a short time. He was in Volozhin 2, so to speak. He was too young for Volozhin 1. He studied in the Mir Yeshiva as well, but he was a kid, and he wasn't allowed into the shiurim, the classes where the senior students would study. And so he describes in his introduction to his central work called the Shevet Miyehuda, how he used to have the older students convey to him what they had learned in the lectures. So they would hear the lecture and then they would repeat it to him, and that was his way to get access to more sophisticated material. He studied under a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Shimon Shkop, who was one of the major leaders in pre-war Europe. He was ordained by Rav Rafael Shapiro, who was the one who had reopened the Volozhin Academy in 1899. He himself launches his career as a Rosh Yeshiva. He starts an academy of his own in a town called Vishnieva, but he finds that he has throat problems, and he's not able to teach, to lecture on a daily basis. It's affecting his throat. And he writes all about this in his introduction to Shevet Miyehuda. So he decides to go into the communal rabbinate, which evidently did not involve as heavy a speaking role as it does in North America today, so that it's safer for his throat. And he serves in various Lithuanian communities from 1910 until 1924. Every community he moves to, he believes, has to have an academy for Torah study, a yeshiva. And so he opens these yeshivot everywhere that he goes, if one doesn't already exist. In 1924, though, he becomes the chief rabbi of Liverpool. Now, this nice boy from Brisk moves to Liverpool. He has to learn English, which he does. He masters English, and he becomes a great speaker, and he unifies various local congregations. He becomes a central figure there during World War II. During the air raids of World War II, many Liverpoolians flee Liverpool, and he remains saying, I'm going to tend to the local population as well as refugees who are flooding there from elsewhere in Europe. He's also a major figure in England's Zionist movement at the time, the head of the Mizrahi. Now, in 1946, he makes Aliyah, and he becomes the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. In the 1950s, he joins what's called the Chief Rabbinate Council, the Council of Rabbis who assist the Chief Rabbis. And then in 1964, the first Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel, Rabbi Yitzhak Halevi Herzog, passes away. And at that point, he is appointed to become the second Ashkenazi Chief Rabbi of the State of Israel. And he serves from 1964 until 1972. He retains this very British identity. He retains the top hat, for example, as did Rav Herzog before him. But his term concludes in 1972. This is that switch to no longer have life terms, but instead to be elected every 10 years. So Rav Gorin replaces him. Last week, was there a discussion about the Langer affair? Okay, so the Langer affair was the great controversy of the day. It involved, we actually discussed it. For those who were in my class at Beth Emeth, you'll remember we talked about this in our series of Celebrating 70. So this is old hat for quite a few people here. But for those who are not familiar, very briefly, there's this great crisis that goes on because of the question of the status of a woman's first husband who was not born Jewish but may have converted to Judaism, and then she ended up marrying a second husband without a divorce from the first, and then she had children who were serving in the IDF. And the question was, would they be mamzerim? Would they be allowed to get married or not? I'm not reopening the whole discussion. Maybe what I'll do is I'll send out later, when I send out the follow-up email from today, I'll send a link as well to the audio from the classes about the Langer affair, and then we can talk about that at greater depth that way. But the bottom line is that that there is this major crisis going on. Rabbi Shlomo Gorin is prepared to be lenient in it. Rabbi Unterman stood his ground and said no. And Rabbi Gorin ends up being elected the chief rabbi. At which point Rabbi Unterman retires from that. He runs instead a kollel, a place where people come study. And he passes away in 1976 in Jerusalem. That's just basic biography. I hope fits the family's records. I'm serious about that. If there's anything I'm missing, that should be told. I want to make sure that we get it. He's a moderate voice, an expert in Jewish law, very sensitive to the different parts of Israeli society, as we're going to see, and very sensitive to the needs of individuals. Now, here I included something which has a story to it that I'll tell you afterwards. But in source number 2, I brought you a piece of a responsum that he wrote. He was asked the question, which comes up in synagogues all the time. And the question is this. Two bar mitzvahs, same Shabbos. Who gets to read from the Torah? What do you do? So, in our synagogues, and it happened, yes, where I daven, it happened just a few weeks ago, what you do is you arrange. One of the kids will do the first 4 aliyot, and the other one will do the latter 3 and the haftorah, or some version of that. But he is asked the question by a synagogue in which the both boys really want to read the entire Torah reading, and no one is willing to be pushed off. So, the question is, what do you do? So look at his advice in source number 2. He says, in my humble opinion, the best counsel would be to do this. Before one reads the Maftir, they're not reading the entire thing apparently, they're just doing the Maftir and the Haftorah, so it appears. Before one reads the Maftir, which is the last of the Torah readings, let 10 men leave with the second bar mitzvah to another room. After the first finishes reading from the Torah and prophets, these men return with the second one, he also reads with all of the blessings. In other words, what you're going to do is, you're going to do the maftir twice. You have one read, the maftir, in front of the entire shul, minus a minion that leaves. And then, the minion comes back in, and the whole shul sits there while the maftir and the haftorah are going to be read again. Everyone has to sit through hearing this twice. How many of you go to shuls where that would actually be acceptable? Where people would sit through that? Not my show. I'm sorry. People are not that patient. That's just the way it is. They won't. I mean, they'll take the candy that gets thrown twice. That they'll accept. Maybe if you throw the candy first, then they'll be in a better mood. Yes?
Why do they have to be 10 people?
So the idea is that you can't read the Maftir and the Haftarah with the blessings unless you have a minion that still hasn't heard it. So the minion leaves with the second one. They don't hear the first one read. Then they still need to hear it, so they'll come back in. You're reading it really for them, but everybody else stays. In other words, what he's really saying is, don't split up the minyan. To say, so some people hear it from one, some people hear it from the other. He wants each kid to have the opportunity to do this for the big show, so to speak. To do it for everybody. And look at his explanation. He says, in general, it is worth emphasizing that they must satisfy the minds of the young who enter the yoke of mitzvot and their relatives, so that through this they will draw close to Torah and mitzvot. The reading of a youth before a great gathering is impressive, imprinting in his soul sacred feelings which also have a positive influence on all who attend in his honor, even though they don't attend synagogue normally. Clearly, his reading coming after long preparation is a spiritual experience which should not be taken lightly, so long as it does not, God forbid, conflict with established law and custom. And therefore, he notes, the gabayim, who are in charge of running the service, must be especially careful to prevent empty talk during the Torah reading. This would ruin the effect. The atmosphere of sanctity would disappear. Many problems would likely develop. So he says, you know, people are talking, that really kills the experience for the bar mitzvah kid. Now, I actually went looking to see if he had a stance on bat mitzvah. I didn't find anything, but I knew that would be a question. But my point in bringing this is that he's very sensitive to the emotions of the bar mitzvah kid. And he's willing to put the community through it, even though we have a value of avoiding tircha d'tzibura. We don't want to strain the community. Nonetheless, he thinks the experience for the kid in reading in front of this entire group is important enough that it overrides the concern for the community having to wait an extra 10 minutes, 15 minutes while this goes on. Now, I say this comes with a little bit of a story because I had actually taught about Rabbi Unterman once before and I had included this and I was so impressed that I actually included it in the weekly email that my baby Drash sends out on Thursday morning. So I had included this in it. I really liked the value that he was expressing. And then I was looking for something completely different online, something having nothing to do with this whatsoever. And I found an article in which Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who was a contemporary of Rabbi Unterman, but operating in New York at the time, was asked the same question at roughly the same time. It had to be the same person wrote the question to two different figures and gave the same answer. Not the whole description at the end about the importance of the experience, but the same fundamental answer of the kid goes out and then comes back in and then reads. Which I found to be very interesting, that it wasn't just Rabbi Unterman, Rabbi Feinstein also expressed it. And then I saw who had written the article and it was me. 7 years ago. Which just shows that my memory is failing. But, yes. It's hilarious to everybody but me. To me, it's just like, yeah. Anyway, but Rabbi Unterman was very sensitive to the people he was dealing with, and we'll see more of that. He was also an international voice. He was known for his scholarship. He received questions from all around the world. He won the Rav Kook Prize for Torah Literature in 1954. He actually was invited to tour the United States to raise money for Israel in 1964, and he met with former U.S. President Harry Truman. It was a big deal to host Rabbi Unterman on this visit. He also, as I mentioned, was a very strong Zionist. That was while he was still in Europe, when he was in England, and it continued, obviously, after he came to Israel. If you take a look at source number 3, he was asked about having music on Yom HaAtzma'ut. Remember that Yom HaAtzma'ut occurs at a time on the Jewish calendar, which is usually associated with grief and mourning. It's a period in which we mourn various losses, most famously the students of Rabbi Akiva who died in the 2nd century Common Era, but also commemorations for deaths during the Crusades and the Chmelnytsky massacres. Those commemorations at that time make it a period of mourning, and usually people don't get married, you don't have public music and the like. So Rabbi Unterman was asked, what about the 5th of Iyar, the day when we celebrate Israel's Independence Day? And he wrote, source number 3, actually, the rabbis explicitly permitted music on that day because of, this is in 1954 that he's writing this, because of the great salvation God wrought for Israel, the rising of an independent state of Israel without the yoke of foreigners and enslavement to another nation, the gates of Israel have been opened wide before the masses of the house of Israel in all of its diaspora lands. Through this, more than 600,000 souls have ascended from the exiles. According to our beliefs, this is the start of redemption. And if the spiritual state of the nation does not satisfy us at all, and we should fight it continually to strengthen religion and observance of the sacred Torah and her mitzvot, still, in the beginning of the days of Ezra HaSofer, when the Jews returned from Babylon to build the second temple, it was also thus. We believe powerfully the situation will improve and the nation of Israel will return to the way of faithful Judaism. So he says, I'm not thrilled with the religious character of the nation, but that's not going to stop me from celebrating what we have achieved and recognizing what we have, and he views it as the beginnings of redemption. That's the view that Rabbi Unterman took. So he said that Hallel should be recited on Yom HaAtzmaut without reciting the formal blessing for it. That's a longer discussion than we're going to discuss right now. Yom Yerushalayim, the anniversary of the Six-Day War, the reunification of Jerusalem, he said, say Hallel with a blessing. That's background in general on some of his positions. He blended the role of clergy and the role of politician as a leader of communities. He was very sensitive to the needs of the individuals he dealt with in Israel and beyond. He dealt with a case of a woman who, the question was, would she be eligible to marry? And he ended up saying, if you take a look at source number 4, I don't want to go into the specifics of the event that he's dealing with because it'll take us the entire rest of the class in order to unpack the case. I just wanted to show you one line from his ruling in number 4. You keep seeing Shevet Miyehuda. That's the name for his works of Jewish law. It's a 4-volume set. So he says, I'm inclined to be lenient and have them arrange chuppah and kiddushin for her when 2 expert judges will join me. In our day, the power of leniency is needed for such cases, lest they be distanced further and further from Judaism, God forbid, so it appears in my humble opinion. He makes a statement of policy in the middle, or not the middle, towards the end of this responsum, saying that there is a need for the sake of the Jewish people so that people are not alienated. There is a need to try to err on the side of caution in terms of treating people in a way that will be lenient. Number 5 shows this as well in a comment he makes in a responsum. Anybody here Lubavitch or have a Lubavitch family? Okay, we got one. So there is a practice that I first learned about when my kids had friends who were from a strong Lubavitch home, which is that they don't like to have books with pictures of non-kosher animals. You're familiar with that? They don't want picture books with non-kosher, which is difficult because, you know, my kids all have farm animal books, like, you know, that they ain't just cows. There are horses in them. There are donkeys in them. So bunny rabbits. So that's the thing, though. There's a concern about proximity to a non-kosher creature. So keep that in mind with the following case. The case involved a kindergarten in Israel and a fellow named Mr. Jacobson who objected to them having bunny rabbits in the class. Now, I don't know if he's Lubavitch or not. I just make that association with that practice. Someone asked me, actually, I gave a previous class on Rabbi Unterman, and I mentioned this there, and someone asked me, you know, two of the Lubavitcher Rebbes down the line were named Dov Bear. Right? A bear is not a kosher animal, to which the answer is clearly the concern does not extend to names. That would seem to be the case. But going back to this, it eliminates quite a few animals, correct? Well, look, goldfish are kosher. They're carp. So this fellow, Mr. Jacobson, objects to them having a bunny rabbit in the classroom. Look at this piece of his response. He says, "It is clear that Mr. Jakobson's intent is desirable. He is truly pained by seeing children playing with a non-kosher creature. But he has exceeded proper bounds in contending that this will weaken their revulsion at impurity, saying it could, God forbid, lead them to eat rabbit meat." That's apparently one of the concerns. I would think the opposite. Generally, you don't eat what you play with. But that's the concern that's mentioned as part of the challenge to having them in the classroom. He says, "I really don't think that's going to happen." More to the point, he says, "It appears he was concerned because that was an era of raising rabbits and non-observant kibbutzim, and there was a concern that they would raise them for sale for meat." But he says, "The cases are not at all similar. In such matters, we must be careful not to exceed, for all who add, subtract." If you're going to add stringencies, you will end up reducing people's loyalty to Jewish law. And he says this suffices for those who understand. So he says you take a lenient stance. In another example, in number 6, he was approached by Bar Ilan University. They wanted to do stem cell research on cells from aborted fetuses. And without going into his position on this, in number 6, he was approached, but they wanted his answer right away. And he said, "I have some challenges about how this is going to be done." And he did not agree with everything that had been written to him by other rabbis who wanted to permit. But he said, "Fundamentally, I'm going to allow it with the caveats that I make about how this should be done." But he did allow them to go forward with it. But don't make the mistake of thinking that everything was simply an open check to permit. When he felt something was wrong, he took a stance and he stuck with it. So as an example, when you deal with the issue of abortion, Judaism is not the Catholic Church. We have a long history going back to the Talmud itself and biblical text that says that there are cases when abortion is not only permissible in Judaism, but even mandatory. Right, the most famous case being saving the life of the mother. A lot depends in Jewish law on the stage of the pregnancy. Is it in the first 40 days? Is it in the first 3 months? What exactly is wrong that is leading them to want to abort? What is the level of risk if the baby is carried to term? What will the baby's life be like? There's a lot of responsive literature on this issue. It became a very big issue in the 70s when, through diagnostics, they were able to discover if a baby had Tay-Sachs. It would be fairly late in the pregnancy at the time with the technology that they had, but the question was, are you able then to abort given the horror that's waiting for the parents and the child of a baby based on current biotechnology? So Rabbi Unterman took a very strong position. Rabbi Unterman was against abortion, and he wrote strongly enough that others who had been in favor said, "If Rabbi Unterman is against, I better think twice." If you take a look at source number 7, Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, a major authority in Jewish law, he lived in Berlin, actually during the beginning of World War II. He had Russian citizenship, and there's a whole biography. It's a long story. He ends up in Switzerland, where he lives out his life, and he said that from his point of view, as I brought in number 7, it's possible to be lenient. And then he has a footnote, and he says, "I saw that in volume 6 of the journal Noam, Rabbi Isser Yehuda Unterman, chief rabbi of the state of Israel, Shlita, prohibits aborting a fetus for an ill woman even before 40 days. Not a deathly ill, that's not what he's talking about, but he prohibited even in the first 40 days of the pregnancy, and therefore in practice one must still take counsel with the great authorities." He says, "You know what, if Rabbi Unterman says no, I better think carefully about this." And he carried that kind of weight. He was very concerned, and I was kind of surprised, I didn't hear this voice. He was very concerned about an important value for the chief rabbi of the health of diaspora communities. Meaning, when I introduced the question of what is the role of a chief rabbi, I pointed out responsibility to the diaspora as well, beyond the boundaries of the state of Israel. How do you look at them? Do you look at them as simply those dying communities, right, who eventually are either going to make aliyah or simply disappear? Or do you look at them as part of the Jewish people with Jews in there for whom the chief rabbi must be concerned as well? And he was very concerned about the health of those communities outside of Israel, and in particular And this was manifest in his concern for Soviet Jewry. In 1967, he authored a prayer to be recited on behalf of Soviet Jewry in synagogues around the world before blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah and again before Maariv on Yom Kippur. He believed that there should be a special prayer dedicated to the Soviet Jews. And he authored a landmark responsum regarding conversions of Russian non-Jews who were married to Russian Jews. This is not the issue that would come up in the 1990s about couples who made Aliyah. This is about people who are living in Russia. Although he also addresses those who make Aliyah. I shouldn't say that. He addresses those who make Aliyah as well. But he wrote a responsum about cases in which Russian Jews who were not observant married Russian non-Jews and had some kind of a conversion, but there were many who challenged the conversion because they said, clearly there's not going to be any observance of Judaism in the home. Look at what he had to say in source number 8. I translated a large chunk of it because I thought it was worth seeing. He says, he is dealing with those who come to Israel. He says, especially those who come from Russia and mixed families. In my view, one should not be strict upon them with hard questions. Because, meaning like, will you observe this? Will you observe that? Do you believe this? Because this looks to them like an attack on them. The reality is they truly wish to convert. This is obvious from two aspects. First, they never absorbed the fundamentals of Christian religion, right? Living under the communists. Because they don't learn religion there at all. And certainly among the young, for it is not mentioned in school there. Similarly, their spirits are sick of the prattle of the coarse message of atheism they force feed the young to the point of vomiting. He's a little unclear about his position on this. When we explain the principles of our sacred religion to them, this is like ink on new paper, which is not quickly erased. He says, first of all, they and their children will be open to the Judaism they will be exposed to in Israel. And he says, second, referring to the non-Jewish spouse, those who come from there are filled with bitterness regarding the persecution of Jews, the libels against our religion. Their hearts are very bitter against their non-Jewish friends who didn't protect them, who betrayed their friendship. Therefore, when we accept them with respect, they bond with the Jewish nation wholeheartedly and with the fundamentals of our sacred religion, like observance of the Holy Shabbat, kosher food, etc. And then he says, because I have mentioned Russian Jewry, I feel obligated to mention that God forbid we must never abandon hope for those Jews regarding Jewish observance, those who have come over from Russia. There is basis for believing that when we will live to merit to bring them here, we will be able with God's help to influence them, to draw them ever closer to total powerful faith in God and in His eternal Torah. He's not willing to give up hope on them. And he insists on respecting the conversions that were done, even at a time when others were not so strong in this regard. He believes in trying to pursue the health of this Russian Jewish community. I'm monologuing a lot. Questions here before we go on to the next part. Correct. Correct. And if someone didn't convert, then he's not going to call them Jewish. He's talking about people who had converted. That's true. But he insists on accepting everybody who's coming over with respect, which I think is a major point. Okay. For me, the biggest and most fascinating element here in his biography is that he strikes a remarkable balance between two values that we mentioned at the outset. On the one hand, unity. And on the other hand, the integrity of communal identity. Meaning, like we said in the beginning, if you push for all communities to do the same thing, you obliterate the differences and you just homogenize everybody, you destroy that which made them unique. You destroy their traditions and their identity. On the other hand, if you let everybody do their own thing, then you create division and strife. So there are some who will go all the way one way, and there are some who go all the way the other way. But he strikes a balance between them, and it's really not easy. On the one hand, he pushes for unity. Example, there was a big debate in the early years of the State of Israel regarding how to commemorate the Shoah. What to do to commemorate the Holocaust? Today, you have Jews who observe Tisha B'Av and say, on Tisha B'Av we will also commemorate the Holocaust. Tisha B'Av has been the national day of mourning for Jews since the destruction of the Temple. Various tragedies occurred on or around that time, and Jews through the ages have added added elegies of mourning to be recited on Tisha B'Av to commemorate disasters like the Crusades, like the Khmelnytsky massacres. That's and so for one group, they say that's always been the day of mourning for us. We view the Holocaust as part of a continuum of tragedy, and therefore it gets absorbed into Tisha B'Av. Then you have others who say no, there has to be a separate day of mourning. The State of Israel established Yom HaShoah V'Hagvura, right? That day that is observed on the 27th of Nisan. There's a whole story. You know the story about how it came to be on the 27th of Nisan? So to make a long story short, they actually wanted Yom HaShoah to be on the day of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, because they didn't want it to be about Jews who were killed, just simply Jews who were killed. They wanted it to be Jews who rebelled. That was a very important point in the early state. It's about Jews who actually fought back. That's what they wanted to highlight. But does anybody know what day that was? The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising? Right, and the Hebrew calendar? It was Erev Pesach, the day before Passover. Sorry?
Wasn't it on the
Seder night? Right. So you can't make a day of national mourning at the start of Passover. That's just not, that can't happen. And so there was a big fight about what to do. On the Jewish calendar, the month of Nisan in general is considered a month of redemption. If there's a funeral, we avoid eulogizing during that month. Like, it's supposed to be a happy, celebratory month. So there were those who said, well, let's push it off. We'll push it into the month of Iyar, which is the next month on the Jewish calendar. But those who wanted the association with the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising said, you can't do that, and especially because then it will be close to Yom HaAtzmaut, Israel's Independence Day. You can't do that. And so you end up with an in-between solution, the 27th day of Nisan. Nisan has 30 days, so it's between the 14th of Nisan, 14th, 15th, which is when it happened, and on the other hand, the 5th of Iyar. You put it somewhere in the middle there. It's towards the end of Nisan. Rabbi J.J. Schachter has done a lot of work on this. You can hear his classes and read his articles on it online. But that's how you end up with this day. Well, at the time when all of this is going on, Rabbi Unterman champions a different approach. He wants there to be a universal day of Kaddish. And he puts it on the 10th day of Tevet. And that becomes accepted, specifically and especially by Jews in the United Kingdom, I think largely because of his influence. That's why it happens, even though he's already in Israel by the time this is done. But look at his declaration. It's in source number 9. He says, "Now we have established an ongoing day of memorial for this destruction, the 10th of Tevet, a day of communal fasting across generations. The fast on which the first destruction began is suited for a day of memorial for the last destruction as well at the end of the final exile, meaning the 10th day of Tevet is viewed as the beginning of the destruction of the first temple." So he says, this is our last destruction. Make it a bookend. We observe a fast on the 10th of Tevet for the beginning of our devastation and for the end as well. And he says, on this day it is incumbent upon us to elevate ourselves above the matters of the moment and to be united with the memory of our martyrs. He wants unity of the Jewish people, and so he tries to get everybody on board for this observance of the 10th of Tevet. And you could read the rest there. In the interest of time, I'm not reading the whole thing aloud, but you can see my translation there. He believed in trying to unify everybody. And this results in a very interesting exchange of letters for Rabbi Unterman with Rabbi Dr. Moshe David Tendler. Anyone hear of Rabbi Tendler before? Okay, some people are familiar. Rabbi Tendler was actually my biology professor. He lectures at Yeshiva University. He gives a Talmud class in Jewish law, and he also lectures in biology. That was his career, was biological research. In addition to the rabbinate, he's also the son-in-law of Rabbi Feinstein, who I mentioned earlier. And he's a significant voice on Jewish law, and particularly as Jewish law relates to contemporary issues. Well, One of the questions, a more prosaic question than what he usually deals with, but one of the questions that Rabbi Tendler debated with Rabbi Unterman was the question of the kosher status of swordfish. A little more prosaic. Usually Rabbi Tendler is known for debates about like the definition of death and abortion and things like that. But they also debated the question of whether swordfish is or is not a kosher fish. Swordfish have a certain kind of scale. Rabbi Tendler did a lot of research, and he said those aren't the types of scales that are recognized within Jewish law because a kosher fish needs to have fins and scales. Basically because we have various texts that speak about scales that are on a fish when the fish is very young, but then fall off later, the juvenile scales. And then also the type of scales that we're concerned for are scales that are not fixed, that can actually be removed fairly easily. And the type of scale that the swordfish has, Rabbi Tendler felt, doesn't qualify. Rabbi Unterman disagreed. Rabbi Unterman said, no, he said swordfish is kosher, the scales are fine. And take a look at source number 10, the end of his letter to Rabbi Tendler. He says, and if, as we hope, he, Rabbi Tendler, will find that there is room to rely on these authorities, he will agree to publicize this for the sake of the house of Israel, who are careful regarding prohibitions, and also so that there will not be a division of sects, these prohibiting and these permitting. He's very concerned that you can have multiple rulings. So he says, Rabbi Tendler, if you will listen to what I say, and you agree with me, I hope that you will publicize to the world that it's actually a kosher fish, in line with my position that it is kosher, because I don't want some Jews to think that it's kosher and some Jews to think that it's not kosher. He is looking not only for being right and getting his position across, but he wants there to be unity. He doesn't want some Jews saying yes, some Jews saying no. However, where a community already had an established practice, then he honored it. He did not look for them to change what they were already doing. On a new issue, like the swordfish debate, which was new at the time, he said, let's have it out and figure it out, and everybody should follow the same position. But if there already is a practice, even if it's different from what others are doing, the community should stick with it. Came up regarding the pasteurization of wine. Without going into great detail again, because there's too much to discuss on it, there is a rabbinic decree that says that if wine is handled by people who are not Jewish, then that wine becomes non-kosher. The origin of it is a concern that by socializing over wine, Jews will meet their non-Jewish neighbors, find out that they are nice, wonderful, moral people, and say, well, what's the difference then? You know, if my observance isn't that strong anyway, or if my observance is strong, what does it matter what my spouse does? And they end up marrying their non-Jewish neighbor who they got to know over some drinks. That's essentially the concern behind this. So, there's a... Do you want to say?
I was going to say something.
Oh, okay.
In regards to the kosher wine.
Yeah.
Because the custom was, in order to filter the findings
yes.
of wine... was to use bulls, but or to use crustaceans, or to use there were some other substances, so that went there for
right.
non-kosher. And you wouldn't know that if you
correct.
Were drinking. And even today, they banned the practice about 20 years ago, but there are still some countries that use that practice.
Right. I mean, there have been a variety of methods of filtration over the ages. That wasn't the only. They had mineral filtration also over the years. But you're right. That would argue for kosher supervision, what you're saying, to make sure that that method was not in use. But separate from that, even if they used other means of filtration, you'd still have the problem, if it was handled by someone who wasn't Jewish, of this old rabbinic decree. However, you had an exception to the rule. And the exception has a long pedigree of its own. But the exception is that if the wine was heated to a certain level, then you didn't have to worry about the decree. It's called Yayin Mivushal, literally cooked wine, and that wine can be handled by anybody and it's still kosher. The reason for it go back to a separate concern about wine that was used in pagan practices, and it's a longer discussion. I don't want to get too far afield with it. But the question that came up in modern times is this. You're pasteurizing wine. does pasteurization qualify as a means of heating the wine? Some of the weaknesses of pasteurization as a method are that it tends to be flash pasteurized, so it just heated for a second, for an instant, and then they immediately take it down. Another is that no alcohol boils out, because they reclaim the alcohol through a system of pipes. They don't want to lose the alcohol from the wine. So that's another concern. For a variety of reasons, it's a debate as to whether to accept it or not. Well, Rabbi Unterman receives a letter from a winery wanting to know, does pasteurization count or not? That's the concern. I'm gonna tell you what he said outside, just because I'm looking at the clock and realizing that we're short on time, but it's in number 11. He says, you know, the rabbis in the United States say that pasteurization counts. The rabbis here in Israel say that pasteurization counts. However, there are places in Europe, Switzerland, much of England, which he knows very well, part of Belgium, there are places where they don't accept pasteurization. So he says, I'm willing to write you a letter saying that pasteurization is okay, but you can only include it in the boxes of wine that go to the United States. I don't want you to send my approval to Europe, because there are Jews there, there are communities there who have the practice of not accepting pasteurization. You follow? So he's sensitive, even though he believes it's fine. And in the U.S., where they asked him this question, he believes it's fine. But he's very concerned about tampering with the protocols of other communities. He honors what they are doing. Last example in number 12. Fascinating issue. In Israel today, Jews speak Hebrew with Havaras Sfardit. They have, what do you call it? Mizrach Sfardit. They speak with one type of pronunciation of Hebrew. Jews who came over from Eastern Europe did not speak Hebrew in that way. I don't care if you were Hungarian, if you were Lithuanian, if you were Polish. You were not speaking Hebrew that way at all. You were speaking some variety of Ashkenazi pronunciation. And the question becomes, what do you do in communities where they started out with Ashkenazi pronunciation, but now they gain Israeli teachers who speak Hebrew differently? What do you do for services in the synagogue? So he says the following in number 12. He says, all of this is correct. All of this meaning that you keep to your own practice. May I be rewarded for ruling thus in Liverpool. When young people came from a synagogue in one of the neighborhoods claiming that since their children were taught by an Israeli teacher who accustomed them to read, pray, and learn with a Sephardi pronunciation, they wished to have the Torah reading with this pronunciation so that the children would understand what they read. I strongly oppose this. One may not impose a new order on people against tradition, even if those who seek it are the majority. He says, you stick to your custom. But, next paragraph. Going to Israel. However, there is no proof from this for our case. The makeup of our community has changed entirely since those words were written in 1935. In the interim, hundreds of thousands of brothers have joined, and they have only heard Sephardi pronunciation. Similarly, two generations have been raised, educated only in Sephardi pronunciation. This community is mixed into every synagogue. How could one deny them the right to read in the pronunciation with which they have been raised and educated? Therefore, one should not prevent children from reading from the Torah with the Sephardi pronunciation anywhere. But if they seek to establish a rule to read only with Sephardi pronunciation at all times, one should not heed them, for the power of tradition established across generations is great. Even if only a minority desires not to change, we listen to that. A much more nuanced position. Once the community shifts, and you have such a large percentage of the community that now has a new practice, you have to let them do what they're going to do, but don't impose that still on the minority who remain. Let them retain their practice. And this is really important. We go back to our point about the politicians, the political aspect of the position. It isn't sufficient to say, I'm going to go based on Jewish law and have a narrow vision of it. You have to take into consideration the needs of the community you're serving. We're not going to get to the last point, which is his position in medical halacha. He took many positions, landmark positions, on the interface of Jewish law and modern medicine. I'll give you only one ruling of his that is very important in number 13. He viewed saving somebody's vision as saving their life. which has all sorts of practical ramifications in Jewish law in terms of things like cornea banking and cornea donations from a cadaver, and in terms of when you would do the surgery and what you would do in order to be able to do it. He argued that saving somebody's vision is the equivalent of saving their life. He had all sorts of positions on modern medical issues, which end up being relevant for Jews today as well. There's much more to say. I hope that at least I gave you a little bit of an introduction to this. Next week, God willing, we're going to talk about Rabbi Avram Shapira, I believe. I think that's who I had next on it, who is a very different era and a very different focus in the 1980s. And so that's, God willing, next week. Again, if you haven't signed in, please make sure that you not signed in. If you haven't registered for the class, please make sure that you sign in. Thank you very much.